Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him, Scott Horton. I'm on Liberty Radio Network here from noon to 3 Eastern Time on the weekdays. And you can find my archives. I don't really write anything anymore. That was some old rote that started firing off there. You can find my website, my interview archives, my blog that I don't write on anymore, and everything else at scotthorton.org. Oh, speaking of everything else, there's a chat room. Join up the chat room. It's at scotthorton.org/chat. I am signing into that dang thing now. All you need is a fake name and fill out the CAPTCHA and you're in. You don't need any kind of external application. So if you're at your job and you can't download the Pigeon program or whatever, that's fine. You don't need it. You can just go to plain old browser window, scotthorton.org/chat. Say hi to all the folks in there. Hey, folks. How's things going? Good to see you. It's nice to log into the chat room and see that there's some people in the chat room patiently awaiting my arrival. Or, well, more likely, each other's. Some good people in there, man. Yeah. All right, I'm Scott Horton. I'm looking at the bad news at antiwar.com. It just keeps coming. Obama poised to send special forces to Iraq, a few hundred of them anyway. U.S. Marines and warships head toward Iraq. Pentagon denies plan for coordinating with Iran. Israel warns against U.S. cooperating with Iran on Iraq. Somebody tell them that I said shut up. This whole thing is Ariel Sharon's idea anyway. All the Likudnik's idea anyway. Alright, well. So I saw something this morning that said there's fighting going on in Bakuba and fighting going on in Samara and fighting going on here and fighting going on there. Looks to me like, well, you know, I don't know. It's too early to say. If the ISIS guys are smart, and they seem like they are smart, then they're not going to push too far to the east and get their clocks cleaned because there's enough firepower in the east to keep them out. And I don't know, I guess Maliki's, Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army, I guess may not fight for Maliki. They might just fight with Maliki's army, which is, after all, partially made up of the Mahdi army in the first place, along with the Badr Brigade. So they, I'm sure, are going to work together to keep these guys. There are some attacks in Baghdad, but, you know, there have been accusations by the war party, mostly, I believe, against Bashar al-Assad, that Assad is behind ISIS. And supposedly the proof of that was that while the al-Nusra Front liked to focus on attacking Assad's forces all the time, the ISIS guys preferred to consolidate all their gains out in the countryside and not get themselves killed, taking on Assad's army. And so I never bought that meant, oh yeah, they're all a big false flag, fake al-Qaeda working for Bashar al-Assad, which was the legend going on there. But I did think, I still think, it's an important kind of a fact there that they seem to pick their battles carefully, looking for the longer-term future. You know, the al-Nusra guys, frankly, are a bunch of stupid idiots if they think that they can overthrow Bashar al-Assad, even with all the TOW missiles Barack Obama can hand them. They can't overthrow Assad. He's been winning this whole time, and I guess maybe he can't completely, you know, annihilate them either. But they haven't been winning this whole time in 3 years of war. Doesn't seem like any of that's going to change. But so, you know, if we can draw the lesson from how ISIS has acted in Syria, then they probably would be more likely to just try to consolidate the gains in the majority Sunni areas of Iraq, in western and northwestern Iraq. But, you know, I don't know. There's a guy I follow on Twitter named Joe something or other, and he's been tweeting, oh, I read something yesterday from the Middle East Monitor, something that he had passed on, and I'm afraid I don't really know all about, I don't know all about the Middle East Monitor, but what they said rang true to me, and you will recall, probably, that this kind of theory has been the basis of a lot of my questions for my expert guests in the last week or so, is that Al-Qaeda was never more than a small percentage of the Sunni-based insurgency in the Iraq War, whereas they've really been the supermajority of the fighting force in Syria, if you consider ISIS and al-Nusra. And for that matter, the Islamic Front, which, as far as I can tell, is just a name for Nusra. But anyway, in Iraq, it's been a different thing. You've had the former Ba'ath Party officials, the former Ba'ath Party military guys, the Sunni imams, and the tribal leaders of the predominantly Sunni areas of Iraq. And they were always the basis of the Sunni-based insurgency all along, and they let Zarqawi's guys, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, sort of be their auxiliary, their, you know, their darkie shield, basically, right, from the South Park movie. You guys go out front and get killed, and while we consolidate the gains that you make for us, kind of a thing. And I think that, well, as we saw in 2006, when Petraeus finally accepted their offer to turn on the Al-Qaeda guys in exchange for money and guns and the right to patrol their own neighborhoods and for the U.S. Army to stop attacking them all the time, that then they would stop attacking our guys, they were able to turn on Al-Qaeda and defeat them in a minute. And in fact, at antiwar.com, we had been covering how a lot of the Sunni tribal leaders were getting sick and tired of Al-Qaeda back in, from the very beginning of 2006. There were at least, I don't know, five or six stories in 2006 about the local tribal leaders beginning to turn on these guys, whether they had a deal with Petraeus or not. Petraeus showed up, took their offer that they'd been offering all along, finally, and in fact, he had taken their offer earlier in Mosul, but he was alone. And so he had armed them up with thousands and thousands of AK-47s and other weapons, and then was recalled. It was an incoherent strategy compared to every other general in Iraq who was just fighting the Sunni insurgency instead of trying to bribe them off. So eventually all the guns that he had given them on his first awakening movement in Mosul in 04 ended up going to the enemy. But anyway, when he did it again in 07 and 08, the regular Sunni population of Iraq, they were already ready to turn on Al-Qaeda already because they were sick and tired of their crap because they're a bunch of foreigners and it pushed their authority way too far, declaring themselves the Islamic State when they're a foreign militia coming to help as the minority auxiliary to the local Iraqi Sunnis fight. And so they were quickly and easily marginalized. And now I get back to what I was going to say was that guy, Joe, I think it's Catron or something like that. I don't even know who he is. I'm sorry. I follow him on Twitter for some reason. He tweets good articles, mostly on Palestine, I think. And so he was tweeting a thing along those lines. He tweeted a thing from the Middle East Monitor. Do I have it here? What did I do with that thing? I lost it. But it was about how there's a coalition going on, and they're already at odds in some ways. The coalition between ISIS, the former Ba'athists, or I guess still the current Ba'athists, the Ba'athists in exile there, and then I guess some other kind of local group. And then he also tweeted a thing by Juan Cole making some of these same points, although I just don't respect Juan Cole enough after Libya to really focus too much on that. But anyway, it'll be very interesting to see what happens here and whether there's a there could be a whole other civil war for Baghdad right now. But I don't know. Kind of doubt it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the back side. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm reading this great article by Brendan O'Neill. And my friend Dave just sent me here. Brendan O'Neill at Spiked Online. And, to kind of summarize it, he's saying, I told you not to do that, man. In Iraq, you had a situation sort of kind of like Rwanda, where you had the minority dictatorship backed by foreigners for a very long time. Since back in the days of the Ottomans, they backed the Sunni minority. And they controlled Baghdad. And, you know, there were Shiites in the Ba'ath Party and everything, but it was dominated by the Sunnis. And so, you know, basically what America presided over, everyone said, oh, we got to intervene to prevent another Rwanda all the time. America actually created another Rwanda in a little bit of a slow motion kind of effect. It wasn't as obvious. But if you take the Tutsi minority versus the Hutu majority there, and then once the Belgians left and the leaders, not everyone, but the leaders of the Hutu majority went after the minority for revenge and genocided the crap out of them for, what, 2 months in a row or so, 6 or 8 weeks there back in 1994. Well, that's what George Bush did, basically. If the Shiites or the Hutus, they got to take their revenge. Their leaders, not every Shiite Arab, was hell-bent on revenge due to blasphemy or some nonsense. It was a matter of political factions. The Americans backed the Badr Brigades of the Supreme Islamic Council, who've been living in Iran for 30 years, and they were hell-bent on the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad and on taking control of the government, and they did. And the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who's an Iranian, but who lives in Basra, in the beginning of 2004, he called for one man, one vote elections. They wrote the Constitution that fall, and then they held the Purple Finger election in January of 2005, where the United Iraqi Alliance came to power. And that was really what started the civil war right there, was the majority won the election. And then, you know, the Sunni, the former leadership of the Sunni tribes and the Ba'ath Party and their religious leaders, they fought back. And, you know, I don't know exactly who did the Samarra Golden Dome Mosque attack, but that's one of, at least, the most important shrines to the Shiites. And when they did that, that really, you know, in 2006, that really helped to get the thing going. But it was really the democracy itself that America had put in power there that led to the war. And so, as he's saying here, you know, the country is just splitting apart as a result of the intervention in large scale. As I've been saying, I don't think that these Sunni-based militias are going to, I doubt they're even going to really try to retake Baghdad. They might try to bring down the Maliki government, but I just think of it like, hey, if it took the Army and the Marine Corps to help the Badr Brigades and the Mahdi Army kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad, then how the hell is, you know, our ISIS and a bunch of former Ba'athists going to be able to kick them out and take the city back? If it took 5 years of hard fighting by the U.S. Army to help get the Badr Brigade's dirty work done for them there. So it just seems like that's a brick wall that they're up against. They lost Baghdad. That part of the war is over, but they're declaring independence in the east, at least. And they may push it too far and get themselves annihilated. You know, they can you know, hurdle themselves up against the brick wall that is Baghdad all they want, I guess. Suicide themselves until there's nobody left. But I think they're going to learn pretty quick that they're not going to make too many gains where the Mahdi army lives. You know what I mean? And there are other Shiite militias besides Sadr's militia, too. But, you know, Bush, and I'm a broken record on this, but it's just true. You know, and in fact, I'm disagreeing with Eric Margulies about this. I mean, and I don't know exactly what would have happened. We're talking about counterfactual fantasies here. But Bush sided with the most Iranian-backed faction, the Supreme Islamic Council, Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, and his guys, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and their army, the Badr Brigade. Now, those were the guys who wanted to do what Iran wanted the most, and what they wanted was, quote-unquote, strong federalism. Why try to fight for and conquer and occupy all of Kurdistan and all of Anbar province forever? If you're the Iranians, that doesn't make any sense. To even try to back the Shiite majority of the country and dominating the rest of the country, that's why fight? But they could take the majority of the country where the majority live, and then go ahead and take the capital city too. That's fine. So that was who George Bush sided with, and that was what he did. On the other hand, if, say, locals had just assassinated Saddam Hussein and his sons, or the Shia had done an uprising and America had stayed out, and they had just, you know, turned army divisions on Baghdad and et cetera like that, well, then it wouldn't have been, I mean, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigade would have showed up, but without being backed by the United States, I think it would have been much more likely that people like Muqtada al-Sadr would have come to the fore, would have been able to marginalize them, and would have been able to focus on what was his project in the beginning, for a fact, was his project in the beginning, trying to create a nationalist unity Arab government with the Sunnis against Iran and America. End the occupation, end all the foreign intervention, and of course the Saudis too, end all foreign intervention in Iraq. That was Sadr's position. That wasn't good enough for America. So, you know, maybe Iraq didn't have to be broken in three, but America sided with basically the secessionists, the majority, but secessionists. And, you know, Maliki, as horrible as he's been about, you know, including the Sunnis into the government and trying to make one Iraq and create a nationalist alliance, and he's not with the Supreme Islamic Council, he's with the Dawah Party, but they're certainly on the same side of that debate about federalism. He was the compromise candidate between the Sadrists and the Supreme Islamic Council guys, but still, the Dawah Party, he also lived in Iran for a while, lived in Syria for a while, lived in exile, beginning with the start of the Iran-Iraq War. You know, that Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan launched. But so he has not lived up to the promise of the so-called surge that if we just stop fighting for a little while, then we can work this out in the parliamentary democracy and this and that. He basically outlawed all the Sunnis and chased all the Sunni leaders out of all the top-level positions in the government, chased the vice president all the way to Kurdistan and then to Doha, I think, right out of the country. And he has been merciless in, you know, shelling protesters and using armed force to clear protest, peaceful protest movements and all that. But on the other hand, he has not really been hell-bent on trying to conquer the Sunni provinces. And the reason that all the soldiers turned and ran was because they were ordered to retreat. Because he doesn't really have the power, so at least he's smart enough to try to not really try to hold on to that part of Iraq. It's already lost. So much was Iskey's plan all along. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Did I mention in all my rambling and raving that Jason Ditz is coming on the show. Ramblin' and Raven? rambling and ranting, rambling and talking, babbling, maybe. Jason Ditz is going to be on the show. And Jesse Frenzblau. Now, I ain't never spoken with Jesse Frenzblau before. Jason, I can promise you, is going to tell you some things that you need to know. Jesse Frenzblau, I can anticipate, will. I have supreme confidence in Jason. This Jesse guy, hey, I don't know, but he wrote this thing, and it's all about Libya, and nobody else got anything right about Libya, so I want to have him on. Libya, A Cautionary Tale, by Jesse Frenzblau. It's at Foreign Policy in Focus. And, yeah, I kind of have my own little thing to say about that, so I'll be happy to hear his anyway. What a strange world. All right, so, man, I got so many things to talk about. My friend Nick Giambruno from Doug Casey's outfit just sent me a link to this thing. Are you kidding me? You know, this world is such a strange place. Did you ever notice that? Iraq war boosters get second chance in media spotlight. And by that, he means they get their, you know, 11th chance. These guys, they just never go away. And the thing is I had seen a couple of tweets about, did you see that Paul Bremer actually got challenged on some things by one of these TV ladies? But did you also see Paul Wolfowitz is on there giving his expert advice? What? But I had no idea it was this bad. I just scanned this article during the break real quick. And so, of course, yes, there's Wolfowitz, there's Bill Kristol. Those two people, other than George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, those two men are the most responsible for that war. Right there. Of course, Tony Blair is back saying it's everybody's fault but his. But then, man, they published Douglas Feith in Politico? The effing stupidest guy on the face of the earth, according to the effing second stupidest guy on the face of the earth, Tommy Franks? Douglas Feith, the leader of the Office of Special Plans? The guy that gave George Bush a briefing in the White House in the Oval Office about how supposedly Mohammed Atta met with Iraqi intelligence in Prague? That guy? The guy that disbanded the Iraqi army? Him? Andrew Card, who of course helped Karl Rove head up the White House Iraq group that ran the media coordination campaign to lie into war. Robert Kagan, co-author of Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy and every one of Bill Kristol's opinions. And even a new book saying we can't give up the empire. Superpowers don't get to retire. Well, that's funny. Tell that to the Russians. They got to. Anyway. And then get this. This is the part where, oh, come on, guys, really. I mean, really, why not? Why not? Even former New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who has become synonymous with the media's failure, that's putting it quite politely. During the run-up to the war in 2002 and 2003, recently appeared on Fox News to, of all things, criticize media coverage of Iraq. This is the author, the principal author of Saddam Intensifies Quest Seeking, or to seek, it's a poorly worded headline. Saddam intensifies quest to seek A-bomb parts. Lies. The reason I say why not, though, is because her co-author, Michael Gordon, has been writing at the New York Times this whole time. He was never held to account whatsoever. She was only held to account as the scapegoat for the entire rest of the media that was all just as bad as her. Virtually everyone at ABC, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, Fox, they were all, and all of the newspapers, just horrible. The exceptions are so few that, and I mean of the mainstream press, that, you know, what do you got? You got McClatchy, Knight Ridder at the time, Knight Ridder Newspapers, Jonathan Landay, and Warren Strobel. They did their work. There were a couple of good reporters, I guess, at the Washington Post. I don't know if they were even good reporters. There were a couple of good stories broken at the Washington Post, like how the aluminum tubes had been debunked as possibly being for nuclear gas centrifuges. Give us a break. A couple of things like that. But for the most part, well, you remember 2002 and 2003. It's absolute consensus. And, you know, it was funny, too, because for anybody who was bulletproof to such things, who just could not be swayed by such things, watching everybody else was like, it was the slowest motion train wreck in the whole world. And at the same time, it was like a really bad comedy or something, you know? And I've told this, and this poor lady, she's just some loser lady. I shouldn't shoot down, but I don't know her name. She doesn't listen to the show anyway, so it's okay. But I'll never forget this lady, and there were 100 more like her. But this one lady, I remember right where I was and everything. Northbound I-35, driving my taxi cab, just crossing the river near downtown, and the lady in the back seat is telling me, well, I say we just go get Saddam and get out. And I said, yeah, but haven't you read about the guys who want to do this war? What they want to do is they want to put a bunch of bases there and colonize the place and stay forever. And so getting Saddam is really just the excuse to try to go there and conquer the place and stay forever. So, you know, maybe you should rethink about going and getting Saddam and get out. Well, I just think we should go and get Saddam and get out. Well, yeah, but they, you're just helping give permission. You're acquiescing to them staying forever, to them launching more wars from that same land. Well, I just say get Saddam and get out and blah, blah, blah. And then later in the conversation about the weapons and whatever, the same lady says to me, well, listen, and you heard this one a million times, you could say it with me now. Listen, the president has access to a lot of secret information that we don't know about. It didn't matter that they were doing the accusing all day long. Oh, we accuse him of this, we accuse him of that. We accuse them of having sarin. We accuse them of having VX. We accuse them of having anthrax. We accuse them of making nuclear weapons, or trying at least to come up with some weapons-grade uranium. And yet, where was the evidence for any of it? Nowhere. Oh, but, you know, the evidence is secret. But, you know, and people rationalize this. You know how it is. People rationalize. They couldn't possibly be lying this bad. And yet, for those of us, again, for those of us who couldn't be swayed to see all this happening, you don't remember that ever since the fall of 2001, they've been announcing regime change in Iraq is next. Oh, yeah, reasons? Because we want to. Oh, better reasons. Let's see. He's going to nuke you. It was so obvious. The policy is regime change. All of the reasons are excuses. If you fell for that, then you wanted to be lied to. Because any of us who didn't want to be lied to could see right through it, and that's 150 million of us. Okay? That's half the population of the country, at least, knew better. For a year and a half, they said, right now we're going to tell you whatever lie we need to get you to go for this thing. And so, who believed Judith Miller? Saddam's making A-bombs. Give me a break. But it was enough. Got the job done. Got the war started. And then, yeah. And this has been the same story this whole time. About the media, too. Just like in the government, there was no accountability whatsoever for anyone in the media. Except for Judith Miller, their scapegoat. And that's why they're all still so bad on it to this day. They don't know anything about it. They never asked somebody who knew. This whole time.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Me. How's it going, guys? It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org. ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org. Click around. Hey, I got a new bookstore. I don't think the link's on the front page yet because it ain't quite done yet, but go ahead and check it out. It's getting started. There's still a lot to go, but there's about 300 or 400 book recommendations or so in there. ScottHorton.org/books. Check out the chat room, ScottHorton.org/chat. Especially anybody Tom Woods just sent over here who's listening. Hi, Tom Woods' friends. Thanks for tuning into the show. Check out the chat room. It's at ScottHorton.org/chat. Tom Woods just put out a nice tweet urging everybody to follow me and listen to my show. So, cool, man. Happy to have y'all here. Good old Tom. It's been way too long since I had him on the show. But he's a very busy guy. And I don't really like to do my invites more than 5 minutes in advance. Which is why I've been getting many people on lately. Anyway, hey, listen, I'm about to talk about Iraq some more. In fact, I decided I am going to go ahead and go through this list of things this Juan Cole wrote. Because Juan Cole, he's horrible on Libya. I can't believe he was for that war in Libya, man. What a disaster. But the truth is, there's a reason I interviewed him so many times about Iraq. He was really good on it, man. And he was right about it. I mean, the things that he explained to me in 2004 and 2005 and whatever. Yeah, he knew what was going on. I think that's when I first started interviewing him, was 2004. And yeah, he definitely was right about pretty much everything, except whether to do it or not. He supported the war. It's like he even urged intervention regime change in Iran in 2009 and in Libya in 2011. And what the hell kind of a peacenik supports every damn war? But anyway, I'm going to get to that in just a second. But I got to talk about this because I got to talk about this. You know, because I want to. And I have to do what I want to do. Did you ever remember that part of the movie V for Vendetta where William Hurt, who interestingly plays the victim, our protagonist, Winston Smith, in 1984, in the best version of the movie of 1984. Anyway, he's the dictator in V for Vendetta, and he's instructing all of his Gestapo ministers to go out there and scare the crap out of everybody and let them remember, as he bellows, why they need us, right? And so that's the thing, like Robert Higgs says, all governments have as their basis fear. What might happen to you if they weren't here for you? That's what it's all about. And there are, you know, 1984-style rocket bombs falling in your neighborhood every once in a while just to remind you you're at war with East Asia, and that kind of terrorism to remind you why you need them. But at the same time, they have, and this is true in Orwell too, the foundational myths. That's the whole thing about he who controls the past controls the future. They rewrite the past however they want. So that everything good came from the party, and everything dangerous, you know, that was outside it has finally been vanquished to all of our betterment. And so you know what I'm going to talk about, right? Exactly, the Great Depression. It's one of the foundational myths of the modern American empire, is that freedom caused the Great Depression. And I remember it perfect from junior high. I learned it perfect in junior high. I remember where I was sitting in junior high when I learned in social studies class all about the Great Depression. At first it was the robber barons with their top hats and all the money who kept all the money from everybody else. And the next was, and these top hat guys got so out of control, they blew up the whole economy, and then it just stayed that way. And then even despite the best efforts of President for Life, Franklin Roosevelt, the Depression kept on lasting anyway for another 15 years. And then finally the Second World War came along and saved us from the Great Depression. And there's a slightly different spin on this same narrative, at least the World War II part of the narrative being pushed by an economist named Tyler Cowen in the New York Times this week about, it's not exactly the broken window fallacy, but pretty close, but just saying that, I mean, with no evidence, he says that, you know, governments lower taxes and free up resources to more economical uses in order to wage the war. But that's just not true. I mean, they raise taxes and they ration everything and ruin everything. And as Ron Paul has explained on this very radio show, you think the Great Depression was bad. World War II, for people here at home, was even worse. It was the Great Depression plus rationing. It was Great Depression plus double and worse and even more economic controls than that. But anyway, the myth of the Great Depression is that freedom caused it. A lack of control by the national government in Washington, D.C. allowed things to get out of hand. And that's just not right. It's just not right. And what brought this up today was Dr. Mark Thornton at the Ludwig von Mises Institute has announced that at Prager University, they're going to feature a course on Murray Rothbard's theory of the Great Depression, and you can look that up at bastiat.mises.org. That's their blog there at mises.org. And Rothbard's theory of the Great Depression is correct. You know how I know? Because Robert Higgs agrees, and so that's all you need to know. And so here's the thing. What happened, man, was they already had a giant inflationary bubble throughout the 1920s. A lot of it was disguised by huge expansions in production, too. And so prices on the shelves, regular price inflation, even though the currency was being inflated by the central bank and the Federal Reserve System in concert with the banks of the country, a lot of the price inflation on the shelves was being disguised by lower, you know, downward pressure on prices from increased productivity and technologies in the roaring 20s and all that. But then in 1927, it was still a distortion in the market, though. Prices should have been falling that whole time, but they weren't. And so it was still a distortion, even though it looked like price stability, it should have been going down. Prices should have been going down because of the increases in production and all that. So, but then what happened was in 1927, the English had a crisis with their currency. And Montagu Norman, the head of the Bank of England, asked for a favor from his protege, Benjamin Strong, the head of the New York Fed, who at that time basically served the role that the Open Market Committee chairman fills now. And, you know, basically the boss of the central bank in disguise. I mean, they call it a Federal Reserve System, but it's basically a central bank in disguise. And back then, the shots were called by the head of the New York Fed. And so what he did was he inflated the U.S. currency in order to prop up, in order to create a bubble, in order to prop up the British pound on the international markets. And in doing so, he inflated a massive stock market bubble. And now you're caught up to the history that you already learned in junior high. There was a big, big bubble. Why? I don't know. For some reason, all the credit went to the stock market and people were buying stock on credit and they were just bidding up the prices of the stock so far out of reality that then boom, pop. But where was all the credit coming from? Follow the money all the way back to where it came from. And where it came back, where it came from was the legal authority of the government, supposedly, to license the right to counterfeit to the banks, that they may expand this much bank credit out of thin air. And so that's where the bubble came from that blew up in 1929. And I don't know what, I think Richmond was not convinced by this, but I don't think he had read the thing I was referring to yet either. And I don't know what Bob Higgs or Rothbard say about this off the top of my head. I need to go back and read Depression, War, and Cold War. So do you. And also The Great Depression, America's Great Depression by Murray Rothbard. But I'm trying to remember. Oh, crap. Now I can't remember what I'm trying to remember. Stockman says in his speech about Keynesianism and the warfare state, that the Great Depression was already coming to an end, that all the numbers from the last quarter of 1932 were way, way up. The markets had settled. The Great Depression was ending, despite all of Herbert Hoover's best efforts, which were horrible and counterproductive. And then FDR rode into town and declared a bank holiday and outlawed gold and declared war against the economy, created an American fascist state, and kept the Great Depression in place for another decade and more. That's the story of the Great Depression. And so, back to the original point, you don't need them. Why you need them is a myth. The basic foundations of their power are based on false fears. So get over it and embrace liberty.
Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Man, I need to watch that clock a little closer. I just barely made it by the nickel of the dime. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How's it going?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. And so, I don't know, man, I guess go ahead and take us through it. What's going on in Iraq?
Well, nothing good. Of course, ISIS, which is the Islamic State for Iraq and Syria, and which also used to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has taken over a good chunk of Iraq at this point. And they're moving on Bakuba today. The interesting side note to the Bakuba story is after all the reports we've had of ISIS forces executing people they captured, there's a report in the New York Times today that the Bakuba police, before they fled from their police station, executed a bunch of Sunni prisoners.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw a tweet along those lines. I guess that's a confirmed report now. You're looking
yeah.
Like
as close as anything is to a confirmed report in Iraq these
yeah.
days.
Right. All right, and now, so remind me where Bakuba is compared to Baghdad, for example.
It's 35, 40 miles north, so it's very close.
Yeah. All right, and so now what of... well, so there's a few things. I guess there's the American politicians posturing. I guess I'm more interested, first of all, in what Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi Army are doing, what the Badr Brigade is doing. Is there still a Badr Brigade outside of the Iraqi army? Does it look like they're ready to fight for Baghdad, or is the Maliki government falling apart here? Is it going to be left just to the Sadrists, or what?
Well, it's not really clear what's happening with Baghdad. As far as I can tell, there's not a Badr Brigade anymore. The Mahdi Army is still a thing, although not nearly to the extent that it once was. And Ayatollah Sistani, of course, issued a call to arms last week for Shiite volunteers, and got quite a few of them, but... exactly how many, the first day we reported 4,000 or 5,000 volunteers, and where it stands now, I just don't know.
Yeah.
But for right now, the defense of Baghdad is still being managed by an Iranian general, and Iran has 100 to 150... Quds Force fighters on the ground.
Man, remember Bush in 2005 saying, hey, as they stand up, we'll stand down. We're going to build them this army. First time they get into trouble, they withdraw from all the areas where the trouble is, and then they call in the Iranians to run the whole damn battle for them.
Right.
Sorry, I can't help but point that out, all that. Oh, we can't cut and run now. We got to finish standing up this army. Oh, man.
And
years went on under that excuse, you know?
Now we have the report that ISIS has got U.S. Stinger missiles, which officials are saying they looted from one of the many Iraqi military bases that they took over, which is entirely possible, But I can't help but wonder, with the U.S. still shipping Stinger missiles into Syria and ISIS being the major rebel faction in Syria who controls most of the border crossing, how many of those missiles they might have gotten directly from the United States.
Right. Are they giving them Stingers, too?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, I knew they were giving them anti-tank missiles, but, you know, they always say anyway that they're afraid to give these guys, you know, surface-to-air shoulder-fired missiles because they're afraid of what will happen to the jetliners, you know?
Well, the Saudis started sending sort of the Chinese equivalent of a Stinger missile earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And more recently, the reports have been that they were sending some U.S.-made ones as well.
Now, I mean, I know that they have had, they've shot down some helicopters and have had surface-to-air missiles, but I guess, at least, you know, from my Discovery Channel knowledge, the actual Stingers are radar-guided and very accurate and are the kind of thing that, I mean, they were terrified of even lesser shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles getting in the hands of the Libyan rebels and getting out to the market, even as they were, you know, collecting arms to send to Syria for the war. They were, I think, weren't they trying to weed out the surface-to-air missiles and keep those off the market?
The SA-7 missiles that Libya had such a huge number of.
Yeah. I mean, and it makes sense for them to be paranoid about that. You know what I mean?
Jeez. Yeah, because even the moderates in Syria, the Free Syrian Army, which is the carefully vetted good guys of the U.S., have openly said they will attack civilian airliners in Syrian airspace because they consider them legitimate targets.
Yeah. By the
way, I mean, ISIS hasn't said as much, but one can only assume ISIS is willing to shoot about anything if it is to their benefit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems like the fact that we had a French veteran of ISIS kill two Jews in cold blood at a museum in Brussels a few weeks ago, to me, that's just the very first one of a long line of blowback coming. And, you know, I hate to sound like a hawk on this because I'm certainly not for the U.S. government's existence at all, much less doing anything in this case. But I do think that there is a danger. I just think not doing something is the best way to decrease the danger. But it seems like there's going to be a long line of blowback from the intervention, as you point out, on both sides and all around in this thing.
And the interventionist argument is always, well, we can't just sit by and do nothing now. But if we sit back, if we sat back and did nothing 10 years ago, 12 years ago, how much better would this situation have been? And even if U.S. involvement might forestall the fall of Baghdad or allow the Iraqi government to retake some portion of the territory it's lost, how many other unforeseen consequences is it going to generate?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the headlines on the page today. Is I think it's a McClatchy story about this Qatari, whoever, some expert, somebody saying, hey, you know, if you team up with the Iranians on this, that's going to be a whole other thing, too. I mean, the fact is, of course, as I know you are well aware, as we've been writing about at antiwar.com all along, the whole war basically was fought on behalf of Iran, while the Saudis were financing the Americans' enemies in the Sunni-based insurgency in that whole damn war. Mostly, I think, because of the stupidity of the neocons in believing Chalabi's line of crap about how they were going to get a water and oil pipeline to Haifa and a Hashemite king, or at worst, Ahmed Chalabi and the gang to run the place for him and whatever, and how that didn't work out. But they haven't really emphasized that, right? I mean, they even like denied it and tried to blame the Iranians for all their problems the whole time, and I guess nobody was really buying it in the Middle East. But if they were outright, I don't know, flying drones as air cover for Iranian Quds Force guys on the ground, you know, the blowback from that, from the rest of, you know, the Sunni parts of Arabian lands, another decade worth of consequences there, too. So,
oh, at least.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're Bush fighting against him, or you're Obama fighting for him, or now against him again, or whatever it is. It seems like either way you intervene, you only make matters worse. The only answer is to back off.
Right, and the danger of ISIS, as real as it is at this point, seems like it might potentially be softened a little bit just by the fact that they have this Islamic State of their own now. I mean, this really is a state at this point.
Right, so in other words, they became conservatives. They changed from radicals to conservatives 3 days ago. We should look for them to consolidate these gains. Good point. That's Palpatine's first lesson when I got to Coruscant was people with power don't want to lose it. We'll be right back in just a moment with more from Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the line with Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com. And, yeah, the hard break kind of interrupted us there, but you were saying that there's a chance that these ISIS guys might want to slow down a little bit and consolidate their gains, Jason.
I think. Yeah, I think so. I mean, most of the sort of low-hanging fruit, especially in Iraq, is sort of already taken at this point. They seem to be reluctant to get into any fighting with the Kurds. Baghdad is an eventual goal, but I don't think it's going to be an easy fight. And I more envision ISIS launching just continuous terrorist attacks against it for the foreseeable future rather than trying to sweep into it with military forces. And at this point, I think ISIS as an Islamic State is no longer sort of a speculative thing. It's just kind of the reality of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it went from the name of a group who, I think it was Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy even was saying the other day that when they named themselves that was part of what helped turn the Sunni population of Iraq against them back in 2006. Was like, you guys are a bunch of Saudis and Libyans and Syrians and foreigners, Jordanians, coming here and bossing us around, declaring that you're the government of the Anbar province. Screw you, you are not. We are,
yeah.
And they proved it. And then Petraeus, you know, rode in and pretended it was his parade and all that crap, you know, as we all well know. But, you know, maybe that's oversimplifying a bit. Obviously, there was a lot more to it than just that. But it always seemed, you know, very presumptuous of them to call themselves the Islamic State of anything when they were a militia that never really held any ground at all. And yet, now it's the name of a place. And halfway through 2014, they actually have done it, at least for a time. But now, I don't know. I guess some reports... there's this thing, Middle East Monitor, are you reading that, where they're saying that, come on, this is the, and I think Patrick Coburn wrote a little of this too, this is mostly the Baathists and the Sunni tribal leaders and whatever, just like during the Iraq War. The Al-Qaeda guys are really a smaller percentage. They may be out front, but they're not the real power behind what's going on here. This is the completely fed-up Sunni population of Iraq declaring independence for Maliki's army, right?
Well, that's been one take on it, but every time I hear Baathist remnants, I get suspicious because I'm not clear that there's that many of them left after the U.S. occupation and after being persecuted for so long by the Maliki government. It doesn't seem like there would be a ton of Baathists left, and certainly, there are some tribal leaders that see ISIS as the lesser of two evils here, and certainly they're shoring up the ISIS force. But I think all the foreign recruitment they managed to do in Syria is also playing a big role in this. And ISIS is a lot larger than anyone really wants to give them credit for.
Yeah. Now, do you have any kind of ballpark estimate of how many people we're talking about?
I've heard estimates of 10,000 fighters that are directly ISIS, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's significant.
That sounds like a lot to me, yeah. That sounds like, I guess, more than I would have thought. I would have guessed, you know, less, but I know you know a lot more about it than I do, too, so I'm not arguing with you about it.
Well, and that covers both Syria and Iraq territory, yeah. Although since they tore down the border, the distinction is really pretty minor.
All right, so now the Kurds, as soon as ISIS rolled into Mosul, the Kurds, bland, they surround, which, I don't know, hadn't they taken Kirkuk a long time ago? But that was the news. They rolled their troops in there and took Kirkuk once and for all.
Yeah, and they've been clashing with the Iraqi government over Kirkuk for quite some time. They made it clear they wanted to annex Kirkuk into Kurdistan years ago, and there have been military standoffs there off and on over the past several years, but at this point, with the Iraqi military in full retreat, the Peshmerga just marched in and said, well, we're taking it and we're not leaving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that slow motion, but I guess it was a relatively kind of slower motion sectarian cleansing of Kirkuk the whole time that the Sunni Arabs were being kicked out of Baghdad, the Sunni and Shia Arabs were being kicked out of Kirkuk, where I guess Saddam had forced relocated a bunch of Arabs to make it a majority Arab city. And they already took care of that over the last decade, kind of slowly. So this was, I guess, the final coup de grace on that.
Yeah, Kirkuk has historically been a Kurdish majority city, although it's always had a fairly substantial Arab and Turkmen minority as well. And I'm sure it will continue to.
Yeah, and I know that if you go back, it was actually, you know, a majority Arab city before a lot of Kurds had been relocated there, before a lot of Arabs had been relocated back, and it's been a fight back and forth like that. But I guess it was Barzani, or maybe it was Talabani, I forgot, who said that Kirkuk is our Jerusalem. In other words, you know, we're taking it, and we're not taking no for an answer whatsoever.
I think that was Barzani.
Yeah. So that brings up the question of Turkey, because this has been a wild card ever since we've been talking about doing this war back in 2002, is what are the Turks going to do when Kurdistan in northern Iraq is no longer de facto independent, but is actually independent from Iraq? And it seems like we're getting closer and closer to that point. And I don't know, I guess the Turks and the Americans have been working together to back these kooks in Syria, so. Do you think the Turks would rather side with Maliki and the Shia or with the ISIS suicide bomber types against the Kurds in northern Iraq?
Well, it's a tough call. I mean, independent Kurdistan has always been Turkey's biggest fear in the region, and a big part of Turkey's decision to back the Sunni rebels in Syria was this notion that Sunni nationalists would be much more harsh towards any Kurdish independence in Syria. Then the perception was that Assad was somewhat too soft on the Kurds for Turkey's taste. But at this point, I'm not clear where Turkey's ultimate decision is going to be, because it seems like, you know, substantial amounts of oil are being exported out of Kurdistan. It's really the only stable part of Iraq that's exporting any large amounts anymore. They're building a pipeline through Kurdistan, through Turkey, to a Turkish oil port in the Mediterranean. It seems like the business interests are very much in favor of an independent Kurdistan from Turkey's perspective. It seems like there's a lot of money to be made in having Kurdistan continue to export this oil without having an Iraqi central government constantly bickering with them over who owns it.
Right. All right, and now that we're out of time, tell me very quickly, how bad is the American intervention going to be so far? Just a few hundred guys and some drones?
Well, we've got 275 more troops going to the embassy. There's news of some drones being planned. We've got 550 more Marines in the Persian Gulf on board a warship.
Yep. All right. That's it. Thanks, Jason.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Man, I'm hungry. I wish this show would end so I could go get something to eat. All right, I'm Scott Horton. Yeah. Sorry about the lousy ending there, but heartbreak and unasked question needed asking. That's Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com. Holding down all the bad news for you there. news.antiwar.com. All right. Yeah. Iraq. So, let's see. I don't know. I guess there's a lot of different things to talk about as far as this goes. But, I guess, you know, I would like to point out that America used to back Saddam Hussein and his group that did the coup d'etat against the king back in 1958. He was number three in line or something like that. And they helped him flee, and after one failed coup or something, they took him to Cairo for a little while. The CIA kept him safe there in Cairo and then put him back in power there. And then in the 1970s, Iraq was more aligned with the Soviet Union, got a bunch of weapons from the Soviet Union, and he was, I don't know his exact position, but he was, you know, in the higher councils of power in the Ba'ath Party there. And then in the early 79 or 1978, he did his coup d'etat and became the dictator. And then in 79, America's sock puppet dictator, the Shah Reza Pahlavi, was overthrown in Iran. And, of course, the whole hostage crisis and all that. So then at that point, Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. And Robert Perry, who is not usually very good about breaking the Democrats' parts for doing wrong, he shows how Alexander Haig, working for Ronald Reagan, when he got back from a tour around the Middle East, said, yeah, here's the document from Haig saying he talked to King Fahd, and King Fahd said that he had gotten the call from Jimmy Carter asking him to pass on to Saddam Hussein that you've got the job. Go ahead and get the work done and invade Iran for us. And so that's what he did. And then Ronald Reagan picked up for that very same policy, just like, you know, backing Pol Pot. It was a perfectly reasonable thing for a statesman, for Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan to do, right? They both backed Pol Pot. They both backed Saddam Hussein. They backed Saddam Hussein in a war against Iran that killed approximately 500,000 people on each side. If you want actually to read a good history of the Iran-Iraq War in one article, read The War Nerd. Gary Brecher, John Dolan, he's got three names. The War Nerd, Iran-Iraq War. And he's an entertaining writer, and it's an entertaining story if you're interested in wars. That's the way he tells it. And anyway, so now the problem with that is that Saddam thought that, so the Americans are his best friends. They would never stab him in the back or anything. And so when the Kuwaitis were overproducing from his joint oil wells, and insult to injury, really, were working with the Saudis to keep, and really with the Americans, to keep the price of oil so low he couldn't possibly pay them back the money that he owed them, that he had borrowed from them to fight for them. The Saudis and the Kuwaitis, they, you know, of course, helped sponsor the Iraqi war against Iran. And that was what he owed the money for. And then they were completely screwing him by keeping the price of oil so low that he couldn't pay for anything, much less his war debts. And then they were, everybody always says slant drilling under the border, but really they were drilling from shared oil wells on the Iraq-Kuwait border. And Saddam Hussein asked permission. You can now, thank you to Chelsea Manning doing 35 years in the pen, you can now read the entire April Glaspie memo, the classified State Department cables that Ross Perot tried to demand be declassified back in 1992. Nobody paid any mind to that. But anyway, and there they are, just as Saddam Hussein always said. There, April Glaspie says, we're not interested in your border dispute with Kuwait. We don't get involved in inter-Arab affairs. Secretary Baker has asked me to emphasize to you that your border dispute with Kuwait is none of our damned business. Green as green light can get, other than outright saying, Saddam, invade Kuwait for us. Which is, it really wasn't like that. It was more like, yeah, sure, go ahead. But then, and I don't know whether it was really just a trap. I think it probably wasn't. But the British reacted horribly about this. And Bush Sr. originally said he wasn't sure exactly what to do about it. And then Margaret Thatcher called him a sissy live on TV. Oh, don't go all wobbly on me now, Bush, she said. And everybody had already been calling him a wimp and a loser and a sissy for so long that that was it. Even killing all those Panamanians wasn't good enough. And so that was when he doubled down. And I guess it was Noam Chomsky better than anyone else documented Bush Sr. And his administration's absolute refusal to accept surrender from Saddam. I mean, all he was asking for was to be able to save a little bit of face, please, as he withdrew. And they would not even negotiate with him whatsoever to get him out of Kuwait. They wanted their war. And Jeffrey Tucker actually has a great article. Is it on antiwar.com today, or maybe it's running tomorrow? Yeah, it got bumped. I'm sorry, I bumped it for Flint Leverett. But it'll run tomorrow. It's this great article by Jeffrey Tucker about how the left wanted their peace dividend, and the right, they called it something else, but they wanted that too. The Cold War was over. The war machine had no more excuse to exist anymore. And the Gulf War was the establishment's way of taking that away from the American people. Doesn't matter Soviet Union or not, the world empire is not coming home, and you are not getting a tax break. And Lockheed is staying paid. And so Iraq made the perfect whipping boy. And that's what they did. They beat the crap out of them, killed about 50 or 70,000 people in the war. And then they bombed the waterworks. They bombed the sewage treatment plants. Look, that's outright Nazi war crimes there. I don't care if you're from here or not. If the Canadians did it or the Germans did it, you would go, wow, that's straight up Nazi war crimes. What do you mean they bombed all the water and sewage treatment plants? What were they trying to give the population cholera? Yes, they were. And then they instituted a regime of blockade and sanctions that lasted, no-fly zone bombings. Oh, well, and then they encouraged, Bush Sr. encouraged the Shiite and Kurdish uprising of 1991, right after the war, after he slaughtered about 50 or 70,000 people. He encouraged the Shia and Kurds to rise up, and then actually helped, not just allowed Saddam to keep his helicopters and put down the rebellion, but as we learned on the show recently when I interviewed old what's-his-name, that guy, I can't remember who did that movie about it, the Americans actually landed their helicopters on the highway to Baghdad and stopped an Iraqi army division that was marching on Saddam Hussein, as George H.W. Bush had encouraged them to do. So there were another 100,000 people slaughtered, and with the help of the Mujahideen Ikalk, by the way. Let them eat our trinkteds, their cult leader, Rajavi, declared. And then came the regime of blockade and sanctions, or really the sanctions that already started, but the total blockade and sanctions era, the entire Bill Clinton years, killed another approximately 1 million people, half of them children. To which Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, famously said, we think the price is worth it. And worth it for what? Just to contain Saddam. Didn't matter if he had weapons of mass destruction or not. When Rolf Eckius from the United Nations was prepared to declare and certify Iraq weapons of mass destruction free in 1997, Madeleine Albright preempted his announcement by announcing that we don't care. Because no matter what, we're going to keep the sanctions on until Saddam is gone. And so they did. And so then came the regime change and another million people killed. And finally, America left in 2011. And now that Jihadistan is declaring its borders in the West, George Bush's stand, it should be called, now America's threatening to go back with the Marines and the drone wars in 2014. Can you believe it?
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, you guys, welcome back to The Dang Thing here. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up on the show, Jesse Franzblau will be here to talk about Libya. Hey, it's really important. Even though I know, who cares about Libya? No, it matters. You'll see. And it's not just Benghazi. Yeah, they caught the guy that did Benghazi. If there's anything notable about that, it's that, they used the FBI on a terrorism case. Don't need the military. Don't need the CIA. Just use the cops. It never really was a war. Other than, you know, all the warring they did. But never did have to be, as Jacob Hornberger likes to say. Actually, terrorism is a crime. It's a felony. It's on the books. It's to be prosecuted as such. And let David Addington go to hell. I don't think Hornberger said that. I think that was probably just me. But, yeah. Never did need to really be a war, unless you wanted a war, which is a different thing. All right, now, so remember all that brilliant stuff I was saying earlier about the Great Depression and how the Great Depression wasn't caused by freedom. It was caused by, well, it was caused by government intervention that came after a collapse of a giant bubble in the stock market and some other sectors, which came after the propping up of that bubble, the inflation of that bubble, by the government and its artificially low interest rates and artificial bank credit expansion. And that's what caused the Great Depression. Not freedom. Turns out you don't need them. Well, it's the same kind of thing, and I'm not the best with the metaphors and all that. You know, poetry. But it seems like a pretty clear sort of a parallel, sort of kind of, if you call the Pentagon the central bank of political power in the world. And when they send the Army and the Marine Corps and the Navy here, there, and the other place, that what they do is they end up inflating bubbles of artificially expanded power on the part of certain sectors whose value on the market isn't really that high. You following me? For example, Hamid Karzai. Hamid Karzai is a bubble. The Hazara Tajik Uzbek Communist Northern Alliance of warlords and murderers and drug dealers and drug users surrounding Hamid Karzai. Their power and influence in Afghanistan is like a big housing bubble. Propped up there, first, yes, by the Federal Reserve. And secondly, by the American military that's there to enforce the artificially high value of their power. And when the federal funds rate goes up, when the army leaves, when the intervention propping up this bubble is pulled out from under it, the bubble will pop. And at some point, most likely, the Pashtuns will end up, Taliban or not, but probably the Taliban will end up ruling the whole country. I guess it's possible that they would let, you know, the country break apart and let predominantly Hazara, Tajik, and Uzbek areas separate, but I don't know why they would. When America intervened in 2001, the Taliban were on the verge of total victory. I mean, then again, they had the Pakistanis helping them out, but Bin Laden's men killed Sheikh Massoud, who was their leader. And so the rest of the warlords were broken up after that anyway. And then in came the CIA with their laser pointers and the Air Force with their daisy cutters. And the rest is history. Taliban fled. The Northern Alliance turned right around and sacked Kabul in, what, 3 weeks? 4 weeks? I forget now. But anyway, when America leaves, unless some other foreign power comes in, like Russia or Iran or something, to back up this Northern Alliance government in Kabul, the Taliban's going to come right back to power again. And in fact, never even mind that, just their power is going to go away. Their bubble is going to pop. Now, in Iraq, the situation is kind of different, because in Iraq, America fought on the side of the majority. As I endlessly repeat on this show, helped them in the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, kicked all the Sunnis out, the Sunni Arabs, out of Baghdad. Well, not all, but they made it an 85% Shiite city, which had never been before, first time in history. First time Shiite Arabs have control of a capital city in the Arab world in 1,000 years, since they controlled Cairo briefly back in 11 something or other. So, anyway, America fought on the side of the Shiites and put them in power. And now, Maliki himself and his Dawa party and the Supreme Islamic Council, their alliance, I'm not so sure, could have ever come to power without American help. And in fact, with Muqtada al-Sadr's acquiescence as well, at the behest of the Iranians, Sadr agreed to let the Dawa Party Supreme Islamic Council guy, first Jafari, and then Maliki, come to power there. And so their power may be, their natural power may still be quite a bit inflated from the American money and the American arms that have still flowed to them this whole time. But they also have the backing of the Iranians, just as they always have, regardless of whatever propaganda you heard in the entire Iraq war about how the Iranians were resisting America there. America was fighting for Iran there, fighting for their interests the whole time. They were on the same side, as reluctant as they were to admit it. And even as ridiculous as it was that they were insinuating, at least, that the Sunni-based insurgency was working on behalf of Iran. It was ridiculous. And then they narrowed it down to the Mahdi army. But the Mahdi army were the least Iranian. Again, Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army, the least pro-Iranian of the Iraqi Shiite factions. So, they're a bunch of damn liars. Anyway, my point being, I think we could see the Iraqi army dissolve and the parliamentary system and the Maliki government cease to exist. Why not? I don't know. I mean, it makes more sense of why they would have gone ahead and withdrawn from Mosul and withdrawn from other areas where, you know, they had much less moral authority on the ground or much less, you know, approval of the neighbors for being there. But I think they'll fight like hell for Baghdad, right? Will the Iraqi army disband and be replaced just by militias? I don't know. But I think it's possible that the Iraqi army's done for, that the entire American state-building project there will be completely unraveled. And even though I doubt, like Jason was saying too, he doubts that the Shiites could lose Baghdad at this point, or that even that the ISIS guys would even try to take it because they know how outnumbered they are. They can still wage terrorist attacks against it for the long term. But it could be that the government of the new, you know, southern Iraqi Shiistan is a whole new government in a matter of weeks or months, or maybe a little longer than that, but, you know, maybe in the blink of an eye. How much actual moral authority, popular sovereignty does the Dawa party have? Does the Maliki government have here, other than just who's bribed and cajoled and threatened into having to support him? And he's not an outright dictator, but he's pretty damn close. He stood for election, but of course, the Sunnis were frozen out of the damn thing anyway. Funny how Iraqi elections always lead to more violence. Democracy does not mean individual rights, you know. It just means majority rules. Or at least they try to. But now, so here was certainly what was artificial as far as American power. And again, at the root of it, with the Federal Reserve literally creating the new credit to pay for it all. And that would be the leadership, I guess, or the authority in the Sunni regions of those who are trying to go along with Petraeus and Maliki and work with the Maliki government that never meant to work with them back. Those guys have all been hung out to dry, which is probably a big part of why you see the rise of ISIS now. It's because all those who had agreed with the Americans that, okay, if you swear that this guy Maliki will end up giving us work and sharing oil revenue and giving us, jobs in the army and the police and the whatever, letting us patrol our own neighborhood, it's okay, we'll go for it. You could call that part of the success of the surge, supposedly, but it was just PR, because it never was true. And Maliki, and this was obvious all along, Maliki never meant to work with these guys. But apparently, he recognizes the bubble in his power there and has just withdrawn all of his troops back to Baghdad and areas east and south of there. So maybe he's realizing real quick that that bubble's popped and he's just liquidating his bad debts.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Tonight on Liberty Chat, I don't know, me interviewing somebody. I better figure that out, man. I think I'd like for it to be Dar Jamail if I can get a hold of him. Iraq, Iraq, Iraq. All right, well, libertychat.com, that's where the Liberty Chat is. And there's a lot of great people on there, too. So, check that out. That's 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock Texas Time. Join up. And then, you know, part of the shtick is, too, your ability to interact with the guests much more so than you get a chance to do on this show by way of the chat room there. So, yeah, check it out. That's every Tuesday night, actually, at libertychat.com. My show. And, you know, I don't know who I should interview. Should interview somebody about something. There's a lot of things. I'll have to decide on something. All right, well, like I say, Jesse Franz Blau is coming up on the show to talk about Libya. So that's really important. I also wanted to point out, I saw Barbara Starr, who is the basically the flack for the Pentagon, posing as a CNN reporter over there. She says they're preparing to evacuate the embassy. They don't seem to have much confidence, or maybe they're just really scared to death of the Benghazi thing happening in Baghdad. But I don't know. What percent is their calculation, do you think, that they could lose the green zone? They're preparing the helicopters. They're preparing the aircraft on the USS George H.W. Bush to evacuate the people from the roof of the embassy like the fall of Saigon. Right now. And I'm sorry, I don't know who I'm plagiarizing, but something I read pointed out that, at least I'm not taking credit for it myself, you know, it was somebody else's point that they pointed out. The George H.W. Bush, huh? The filthy SOB that got us into this entire mess, huh? Him. The USS, him. Steaming into the Persian Gulf, brand new aircraft carrier. This is, I guess, its first major mission. Is that right? The USS George H.W. Bush, which was commissioned and began construction in 2003, when this war began, when this war was declared over. Mission accomplished. What a disgrace. You know, I wonder if I have this clip. I need to make one of those cool little montages of clips at the beginning of the show like Tom Woods has, you know, where Obama's saying, now is not the time for profits. Oh, God. Oh, I do have it. See, I have Bush. We kicked the Vietnam syndrome, but I did not realize I do have the clip. I thought maybe I had the clip. I have the clip. Check it out.
This will not be another Vietnam.
And you know what's hilarious about that? Sorry for blasting a hole in your eardrum. That wasn't supposed to go out that loud, was it? Anyway, that was the line that George Carlin mocked, too. This will not be another Vietnam. This time, we're going all the way. Using the sexual slang of a 13-year-old to describe his foreign policy. This will not be another Vietnam, George H.W. Bush declared back in 1990. Or that could have been from January 91. And yet here we are in 2014 talking about the fall of Saigon. Anyway, these guys, these Republicans and Democrats and generals and admirals and CIA guys, they sure are horrible, aren't they? I think we'd be better off without them. We don't even need them to keep depressions from happening. It turns out they cause the depressions. Yeah, we don't need them at all. We don't need them at all. Anyway, yeah. In other news, the F-35 is the worst piece of crap ever. It's such a piece of crap. And did you see the thing? And this is important. Did you see the thing on the 60 Minutes back a week or two ago? And did you see how it was all about the F-35 and how great it is? Man, this plane is great. And they interview a guy who is, well, first of all, the guy in charge of the Air Force guy in charge of the project. Oh boy, is he a hard ass, making sure that Lockheed stays right in line and they don't get paid unless they get the job done and all this. Yeah, right. Sell me another one. Which he'll be happy to. And then they interview a pilot, and the pilot's going, man, you know, the thing is, you just can't compare. This plane is such an awesome airplane in so many ways, even though it does have its problems. Hey, Bugs, we got to work out, but it's such a superior plane. And then even 60 Minutes Tool says, well, now, the other planes that we got, like, say, the F-15, they're just as fast, right? And they're just as maneuverable, right? And so, what makes this plane better again? Oh, man, you know what it is? It's got such incredibly sophisticated sensors on board. Sensors, huh? Well, the 60 Minutes guy didn't ask. Couldn't you just put those sensors on an F-15 Eagle that you already got? That costs, what, $15, $20 million apiece rather than, I mean, again, I'm for abolishing the Pentagon all along. I'm for having no standing army ever. So, retroactively, going back in time, there should have never been one. But, you know, all things being equal here. You couldn't just jam-pack the F-15 full of sensors, he didn't ask. And anyway, so now there's this thing, you can find this in the front lines section, which is right next to the picture article today at antiwar.com. Amazing picture, too. But right there in the front lines section, you'll find the link. Designer of the F-15 explains how stupid the F-35 is. And what's hilarious is he starts out by explaining how stupid the F-15 is. And how the F-15 was a political project of a bunch of money-making generals and Lockheed guys, and they're horrible. And this was back in the 70s, you know, 60s and 70s when they were designed, and they just wanted to put everything in the whole world in the F-15 that they didn't even need. All these, you know, it was the F-35 of its day, basically. And the guy says, so him and a few of his buddies went rogue, and they're the ones, and I've read a little bit about this before. There really was kind of a secret team that took it among themselves, something like this, vaguely, who went ahead and designed the F-16, which, as he puts it in this interview, is much smaller, much lighter, therefore can go faster on less fuel and can carry just as many or more bombs than the F-15 and get several jobs done pretty well. And yeah. And so to him, the F-15 is the white elephant compared to the F-16, which was actually, you know, made by engineers to get the damn job done, not just to pad budgets and that kind of crap. So, and it has been a very popular aircraft as it's been sold around the world, you know. I guess they say it's not a very stable airframe, but the computer compensates for that, and otherwise it works well. So I don't know. What the hell kind of pilot am I? No kind. But anyway, this guy's point is, look, the F-15 was a joke, but the F-15 is a million times better than the F-35. The F-35 is worthless, he says. It's a complete turkey. He says, it's not fast. It's too fat. It's supposed to be stealth, so it has to carry all its weapons internally. That makes it extra fat and slow and crappy, and it's not stealthy anyway. As Phyllis Bennis has pointed out on this show, wasn't it Bennis who pointed out all they need is World War II era long wave radar, and they can see any stealthy plane we got. There's no stealth at all in the world, no such thing. The wings are too small so that it can take off vertically, but that means that it can't maneuver very well, etc., etc., etc.
Hey y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more. Write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. You know, the heartbreaks, they always screw me up. Well, sometimes they help me wrap it up, but a lot of times they screw me up, too. I didn't get to say that the F-35, they cost hundreds of millions each. I mean, they say $200 million, but they're more like $3 or $5 million. And this guy, the designer of the F-15 here, is saying that, listen, they're not going to be able to produce as many as they said, so the price of each one is going to keep going up, up, up. You know, it was in the news yesterday. I mentioned to you on the show yesterday, the British have grounded their entire fleet of F-35s. Why? Flaws in the engine. You know, no big deal except for design flaws in the engine. And there's a million more of them. And it's hilarious to watch this, man. You should see it. Designer of F-15 explains how stupid the F-35 is. It's, again, in the frontline section at antiwar.com. And he says, and it's funny because, you know, the lady interviewing him, I think, is from a Canadian news service. And so she's kind of, you know, naive. And she's just saying, well, so wait a minute. And I guess she knows something about it. Maybe she's just playing dumb a little bit. But she's saying, well, so wait a minute. You're saying it's not fast. It's not maneuverable. It can only carry two bombs. The, you know, fancy helmet doesn't work. Whatever. And it costs all this money. It's not stealthy. It's not even stealthy. Well, what is the purpose of the plane? Why? Huh? I don't get it. You know, huh? And he says the purpose of the plane is to transfer money from the United States Treasury to Lockheed. That is the purpose of the F-35. It's not to win in a war against the Russians. It's to take money from you. As Big Brother explains in his manual, How We Do It, that O'Brien loaned to Winston Smith temporarily there. We got to take all your excess wealth that you could otherwise spend improving your own life, and we have to call it a floating fortress to sink it into the sea. Or we'll call it a rocket and blast your excess wealth off into space so that you can't get to it. Sort of seems that way to me. Anyway, and in this case, so that Lockheed stockholders can get big, fat dividend checks. And they can live like kings. That's what it is. It's a giant ripoff. That's all it is. And then here's the punchline. Everyone knows it. Because everybody who knows anything about fighter jets, but who doesn't have a stake in pushing this lie, has been calling it out as a lie for years and years and years. I mean, I first started hearing about the coming F-22s and F-35s back in the 1990s and how it was a joke because they were designed in the 80s to meet the Soviet MiGs of the 21st century that ain't existing because there ain't no Soviets. And they're way behind the Americans on all their software and radar packages and heat and radar-seeking missiles and blah, 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 supposedly, anyway. And they're just outgunned. Fleets of F-15s and F-16s, F-18s and whatever can conquer the airspace over any country. Just by numbers, because the Americans, and even over Russia, because the Russians just don't have the resources to have enough planes to fight them all off. I mean, then again, I guess they got some pretty good anti-aircraft, so I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying, you know, don't need it, and it's not an improvement. Its only purpose is to rip you off. That's it. And the F-22 isn't much better either. In fact, that was the joke, right? Was that Robert Gates, Bush, and then Obama's Secretary of Defense had said, we got to quit making the F-22. It's a white elephant. You can't even pretend that you can kill something on the ground with an F-22. It's only for air-to-air combat. But who the hell are we going to fight in air-to-air combat? The Russians or the Chinese? We need fleets of F-22s for that. Come on. We got plenty of jets for that kind of thing. What we need is F-35s. So we can bomb targets on the ground. These F-35s that, as this guy's explained, no, they can't do ground support. That's supposed to be part of their role is ground support. No, they can't fly because of their tiny wings that they need to be able to take off vertically for the Marine Corps. They can't fly low and slow enough to find a tank on the ground and hit it with precision. It'll be completely useless for that mission. And yet that was what made it far superior to the completely worthless F-22 in comparison in the eyes of Robert Gates. Yeah, they're ripping you off. In fact, you could think of the government as simply the gun in Lockheed's hand, saying, your money or your life. As they mug you. That's basically their game. And in fact, I could never recommend this article enough, and you might be new around here and not heard me say it before, so I'll beg you. All dignity that I ever had aside, I don't care. I'll beseech you to go and read Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels by Richard Cummings about how Lockheed decided they don't like markets. They're just going to focus on the Pentagon. They decided that back in the 1970s. And then they started just doing nothing but make weapons for the Pentagon. And then they decided, you know what would make it easier to know what kind of weapons to develop? If we went ahead and invented the policy. So come on, guys, let's invent the policy. Now, that doesn't mean that they're really that far ahead of the curve, just that they're trying to be. It shows their mindset. It's not like they had a bunch of MRAPs ready to go for fighting insurgents in Iraq or anything. Sent them out there in aluminum Humvees and soft-bottom Abrams tanks. But anyway, that's their method and their motive. And the whole shock and awe campaign was basically just a Lockheed promotional video put into effect. And the neocons bankrolled by Lockheed all along. All the neoconservative think tanks bankrolled by Lockheed, as well as Exxon, too. But I think they're much more influenced by the military-industrial complex and Zionism than by the oil interests. Although oil, I guess, is part of it. But anyway, so there you go. Yeah, Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And he points out in there how all the neocons, remember I named all the neocons who lied us into war on the show yesterday, Richard Pearl and Douglas Feith and Scooter Libby and Abram Shulsky and David Wurmser and even Stephen Hadley, all these guys that were the Cheney separate government Gestapo office, as Colin Powell called it, they were all Lockheed guys, all of them. Even Stephen Hadley was the only one who didn't ever work for Lockheed directly as a lobbyist or on some kind of board or advisory capacity or something. But he was a lawyer for the law firm that represents Lockheed, so, and had worked on their account for that law firm. So there you go. Hadley, who was the deputy secretary, the deputy national security advisor and became the national security advisor in the Bush years. They're all a bunch of Lockheed guys. And in fact, Bruce Jackson from Lockheed, an executive vice president there, had created the group, the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, that was responsible for not so much the WMD propaganda, but the Saddam gassed his own people and all that, which was true, but ignored the fact that he was working for the Americans at the time that he did it. In Halabja and the Anfal campaign, he was Ronald Reagan's loyal employee, and Ronald Reagan let him use American satellite technology in order to target the Iranians with chemical weapons. Which you can read about at foreignpolicy.com, by the way. There's a great article there about that. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show, on the Liberty Radio Network. Check out my site, scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, if you go to scotthorton.org/interviews. All right, our next guest today is from Foreign Policy in Focus, Jesse Franzblau, and the article is called Libya, a cautionary tale. I've been falling behind on my Libya coverage, so now I'm trying to make up for it. Welcome to the show, Jesse. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Very well. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us today. And so, please update us on General Khalifa Haftar and his coup d'etat in Tripoli.
Essentially, this was about 2 weeks ago now that General Khalifa Haftar made a move to essentially garner his forces to hold siege the National Congress, which is the elected authorities in Libya now. And General Haftar is his main reasoning justification is essentially an anti-Islamist movement, kind of a scourge of the militia groups that are Islamic leaning, and it's somewhat emblematic of what happened in Egypt with General al-Sisi and justifying further militancy and undemocratic activities in the name of purging the institutions of this connection to what he refers to as Islamic militancy. And so that was about 2 weeks ago, and essentially the General National Congress has been able to, they've affirmed the Prime Minister, they've given affirmation there, but it's still brinkering on a pretty dangerous state. And today, I'm sure the readers saw in the latest news, a suspected individual involved in the Benghazi attack was grabbed over the weekend by U.S. Special Forces. Ahmed Abu Katala was grabbed Sunday, and I think news is just coming out today. Mm-hmm. And he looks like he's the suspected leader of the Ansar al-Sharia militia group, which is believed to be responsible for or connected to the attack in September 11, 2012. And so that's the latest development. I guess this latest capture of Abu Katalla demonstrates that the U.S. doesn't have much confidence in the Libyan government itself, and is, you know, taking these measures kind of upon itself, you know, to deal with these security threat situations. And so we'll see how that develops. Supposedly he's on his way out of Libya and will be taken into a U.S. court. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
All right. Now, so as far as Haftar and his coup, is it, you know, fair to say and not worth dwelling on that this is a CIA operation here, or that they're at least, I mean, come on, he lived in Virginia all this time. They are at least somewhat supporting this overthrow of the elected government there. But are they helping him? To what degree are they helping him? Do you know? Is he winning? Can you explain how much power he has in Tripoli now or over any part of the rest of the country or what?
He definitely seems to have a lot of power, particularly in eastern Libya, where he's garnered a lot in his kind of waging this campaign against the Islamic militia groups there. And his connection to the CIA is there's definitely a lot of speculation, but it's you know, of course, hard to say. It's hard to confirm what connection he has or has maintained.
Well, the Marines started moving from, I don't know, elsewhere in Italy to Sicily in the days before the coup, that kind of thing. It sort of seemed like they at least knew about it, and he was their guy. I don't know if there's any more information than that, really, other than sort of everybody knows.
Right. It's hard to say. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure more information will come out, but he does have he certainly appears to have a history of being connected to the U.S.
Well, and it makes sense,
government.
Too, that if they fought a war that has benefited Islamist militias and others so much, and that they've even done so well in the elections, it's the same thing that the Americans have done since 1993 in Algeria, is always cancel election results they don't like, you know, like in Egypt. And
yeah.
So, you know, it makes sense that they would want to, you know, try to take that back a little bit if Obama doesn't want to be the guy that brought, you know, bin Ladenites, not just more influence, but actually to power in Libya. That would be pretty bad for his own personal political problems, at least. Anyway, it could be.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely see, I mean, some of the first statements that came out, you know, on the U.S. side were generally somewhat, you know, favorable in terms of saying, well, Haftar is on a campaign to strike out this kind of militancy that obviously we see as a threat, and so we're not going to really condemn that. You know, they haven't condemned the actions. That's for certain. His connections, I mean, he certainly, so he lived in the U.S. for many years. He was originally an officer with Gaddafi, who helped come to power with Gaddafi in the coup against the king in 69 that brought Gaddafi to power. He was part of that, you know, kind of inner circle, and he fought in the war in Chad, which ended up being quite a disaster for Libya. And it's still murky what exactly happened then. It appears he was captured at a point, and the U.S. tried to, and he was turned against the Libyan government, and the U.S. helped supposedly in an operation there to support him and other former officers who were turned against Gaddafi to create, you know, an insurgency against Gaddafi to turn back against him. That failed, and they gave asylum to many Gaddafi soldiers and officers who had defected to come to the U.S. And from there, they definitely maintain, you know, close relations, or, you know, some sort of relations with the U.S. Government at some level, and reportedly with the intelligence services. I think that's pretty clear. And and so he was part of an opposition group for years and years. And then when the time came in 2011, he went back and started to fight with the rebel forces. But there was a lot of infighting within the rebels themselves, and a lot of mistrust, because Haftar had spent so much time in the U.S. and had these, everyone, you know, perceived him as being very close to the U.S. interest because of his history. And so other generals kind of won out in terms of having greater authority than he did in the National Transitional Council. And then afterwards, he kind of, you know, he still held a large amount of influence, but he was quiet for a while, and even to the point where people were kind of asking, you know, where is Haftar? What is he up to? And it seems that he had been planning this for quite some time. I think he's given interviews and said up to a year, 2 years even, of kind of planning this, garnering support, you know, amongst the militia forces, and doing it, you know, planning this at a time where it was advantageous that he could make his way to, you know, I guess, foment enough instability and create enough power that he could make a run at the next election.
All right, and when's that supposed to be?
It's kind of unforeseen now.
Yeah, because, I can see why. All right, right, well, hold it right there. I'm surprised they're even talking about elections at this point. But hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Jesse Franzblau from Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, wrapping up the show for the day. On the line, I've got Jesse Franzblau from Foreign Policy in Focus. That's FPIF.org, and he's written a really great piece. I hope you'll look at it. Libya, a cautionary tale. Got that right. And so now here's my question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem like Haftar or any of these other guys, Ansar, all anything, have any real power other than, you know, like gangs fighting over neighborhoods. It seems like the Libyan state, such as it was, the dictatorship of Colonel Gaddafi there, having been smashed, has been replaced with nothing. And I wonder how it's working out, really. I mean, is it that much more violent than it was under his reign? It seems like probably the worst part would be foreigners get to run off with all the oil money since there's no organized Libyan force to keep it. But other than that, I don't know.
It's definitely much more unstable. I mean, it's pretty much fractioned into kind of, there was a balkanization effect essentially afterwards where militia forces took hold of cities, and the government in the wake of the conflict essentially farmed out the security tasks to the rebel groups that turned into these kind of non-state armed actors. The February 17th Brigade was a major fighting force during the conflict that was supported by NATO and NATO allies, and they were in charge of security details, in charge of security, you know, around the U.S. embassy, around the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, and these are the kind of factions that essentially have authority. And so you have groups like Ansar al-Sharia, and they themselves have been broken down to even less controllable armed groups. And then you have Haftar's forces, who, you know, I mean, just as of Sunday, have been carrying out renewed attacks, leading to more deaths in Benghazi. And so how far their control will go, it's kind of hard to say, because there are strong factions on other sides that wouldn't, you know, that will, you know, continue to fight. And so,
well, in your article, you cite this number 1,700 different militias, and that makes it sound like, you know, none of them are all that powerful, or they're in the process of consolidating now, maybe?
It kind of, I think, ebbs and flows. They consolidate, they break up. I mean, I think some, you still have, I think, militia forces in Misrata that are somewhat unified. I think they consolidate. And, you know, when they feel threatened by a larger militia, but no, I think they are kind of up and down. And there are so many of them that it is unlikely that one would gain enough control.
But now, is life normal at all in Tripoli and other cities, or it's all just Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome over there, or what?
I mean, normal to the extent of, you know, at times it is peaceful. There are cities that are relatively peaceful, but there's cities with a huge militia presence that still that, you know, it's, you know, hard to tell who are militias, who are the government forces. It's incredibly unstable. And I think one thing that the conflict itself did was infuse even more weapons into the situation. I mean, under Gaddafi, there were massive stockpiles of weapons, but he kept them essentially, he kept a lot of them buried. He kept a lot of them hidden. He kept a strong, you know, relatively strong military, but he kept it, you know, under wraps, I guess, as it is, but massive amounts of weapons, and that was just compiled by the conflict and the intervention, which fueled a new influx of weapons drops that came from France and from Qatar and from UAE, with much of it with U.S. approval, that just added to it and helped fuel these insurgent forces that became these militias. And so the conflict itself has a lot to do with the instability now. And I think that is, I mean, yeah, a huge challenge. And afterwards, there was a particularly lack of interest in rule of law and other, you know, type of state building or support for state building, human rights issues that could have actually, I think, you know, brought security. But it was all. You know, security based.
I was just going to say how grateful I was that the Benghazi scandal, if there's one, you know, value to it, it's that it's completely distracted Obama's opponents from talking about what a lousy job he's done nation building there, because then thank God there hasn't been much pressure on him to go over there and build up an army and hold a purple finger election and all of this nonsense that we don't want to go through again.
Right. Well, what they've been doing, they've been still providing this a lot of military support. A lot of it, I think, covert. And I think that's been the response and the reaction. And that's also, I think, quite dangerous, because as we see more influx of weapons, more influx of training, as is going on in Syria as well, it leads to, I think, you know, the lessons is that it leads to greater instability, I think, is one lesson if we can take it from these conflicts. But it seems to be very cyclical, and those lessons seem lost in somewhat of a amnesia foreign policy approach to the region.
Yeah. Well, you know, Sharon was in a coma at the time, so the fact that he had always said he wanted America to knock off Gaddafi for him shouldn't have counted for that much. And, you know, it seemed like it just came down to, as Michael Hastings reported it in Rolling Stone, it was really just a PR stunt, because America looked so bad after backing Mubarak to the hilt, way after the shark was jumped, and way after it looked so mean that America was still insisting on keeping this dictator in spite of the wishes of virtually everyone in Egypt there, that they said, well, you know, we ought to back the rebels in Libya. Gaddafi, they only just, you know, made friends with him again after a while, and he was no Mubarak as far as a loyal friend of the family to Hillary or anything like that, like in Egypt. And so they decided he was expendable, so they could do basically a PR stunt and make it look like America doesn't back dictators. America backs Democrats fighting for their rights and whatever. And so just to kind of confuse the issue after Egypt, it seemed to me, and then that was what I guessed at the time, and then it seemed like Hastings' reporting confirmed that was most of the impetus for even doing this thing.
Yeah, I think one period of history that's really important to look at is the relationship between Gaddafi and the U.S. and the British in the years leading up to the conflict, when the relationship became pretty close, and I think they were relying a lot on Libya, and particularly on the intelligence after 9/11. To feed the U.S. and U.K. intelligence to track down militants, and they participated in extraordinary rendition campaigns of tracking down Libyan fighting individuals all over, you know, in different places in Afghanistan and Pakistan, mm-hmm. and, you know, individuals such as Abdel Hakim Belhaj, who was rendered and taken back to Libya, and became, you know, and then when the revolution began, became part of the fighting forces.
And then he even sued the Brits in court, which I thought was hilarious.
Sued the Brits, and I think the Brits ended up essentially settling and admitting to the fact. I believe so.
Yeah, by the way, did it, the worst of the Al-Qaeda guys, I mean, because just the fact that the CIA tortures somebody doesn't mean that Bill Hodge is the worst to me, but the fact that he had traveled to Iraq to fight the Americans seemed like, you know, at least during the Iraq War, anytime Libyans or Saudis or Syrians or Jordanians went to Iraq to fight, we called them, at least the U.S. government called them Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and I guess the assumption at least was that they all fought more or less under what we now call ISIS, but then was the umbrella of Zarqawi's group. And then I wonder, though, if maybe the worst of those guys from the Libya war have all been funneled off in the rat line to go fight in Syria and now in Iraq again. What do you think?
Possibly. I mean, some of the rebel forces from Libya have definitely turned up in Syria. That's even openly given interviews and saying, now we're here, we're going to fight this conflict. And so I think it's just emblematic of the uncontrollable kind of Frankensteins that are created when you influx these weapons and training for groups that you think one day are your friends because they're your enemies of your enemies today. But then the next day, when things change, we act surprised as if it hasn't happened again and again. And right. So I think this approach of just...
Speaking
you
of
know,
which, yeah, what about Mali now?
Yeah, I mean, Mali is also a big, I think, consequence, you know, at least partial consequence of the Libyan conflict itself.
Is it still in chaos there, even after the French intervention? Did they just make matters worse?
It's still unstable. I don't know what that was going to solve in terms of the base conflict still is there, right. And I think that's what's happened a lot. It's these consequences of intervention and. That are unforeseen or not even addressed, and then
they
happen.
My song, Jesse. All right, y'all, that's it. Sorry, music's playing. Gotta go. Jesse Franzblau, Libya, a cautionary tale at fpif.org, Foreign Policy and Focus. Thanks very much, Jesse.
All right, thanks a lot, Scott.
See y'all tomorrow. See y'all tonight at libertychat.com.